Okay. So we now enter the unfortunate last day of our Catholic school here in Hestvika. It's at a time when you really begin to feel the impact of the LaRouche forces on the global policies. Jeff referenced it yesterday when he spoke about this new American revolution that is now ongoing. And if you look, and now our people in the US has been studying this Baker-Hamilton report that has been coming out. And this is not usual policy. This is not just, you know, the same academic, we could do this, we could do that, maybe. But it has a very sharp direction to it as an institutional response to the nightmare the United States and the world has been in for the last couple of years. LaRouche said very specifically that you would not have had this Hamilton report in the way it is right now if it had not been because of the election result in the United States. Because of the facts of this shock victory for the Democrats, of course, very much made possible by our activities, it opened up the door of actually cleaning up the mess in the United States. And the Baker-Hamilton report, which on the surface is, of course, the Iraq study group, it's about what do we do with this mess in Iraq, how do we get out of it. But it's not only that, it's based basically, it's a policy document that, without mentioning LaRouche's name, basically takes the LaRouche doctrine from 2004 and says this is what has to be done. We have to have a comprehensive peace solution for the whole Middle East. We have to involve all of the neighbors in the region. We specifically have to speak to those that people call our enemies. Without speaking to your enemy, you cannot get peace. You have to involve Iran, you have to involve Syria, you have to involve all the neighbors in the region in getting a solution to the crisis. You have to solve the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And you have to have not only a collaboration among the countries in the region, but you have to actively involve the United States, the European Union, Russia, and China in the process as well. So if you have to put a word on it, you have to say that what they're really saying is that we need to go back to a Westphalian approach to this thing, like Lynn proposed. You have to go back to the idea of that you create long-term peace by thinking of the benefits of your former opponent and your future ally and friend. Now, the thing about this commission was that this is not just one or two guys. It's called the Baker-Hamilton Commission, because they were like the leaders of it. Baker on the Republican side, Hamilton on the Democratic side, because you have a bipartisan system in the United States.
Are they senators, or what are they?
Yeah, well, Hamilton, I think, is I think he's a senator, established figure in the in politics for going back a long time in the United States. James Baker is not an active politician. He has been like the organizer for Bush Sr. He has been the closest man to Bush Sr. So when the father of the present president says, we have to do something, it's James Baker that is doing it. So he has not only, so to speak, is representing Bush the First, as he's also called in some circles, but he is representing the old Republican Party that was there before you had this neoconservative, totally insane shift. the kind of policy where back in when you had the first Gulf War, that before going to war, the Bush administration would organize the whole Arabic Muslim world to be part of a Gulf War coalition, because you did not want this, you wanted to keep friends, you wanted the United States to have friends all over the world. So this was a very broad coalition, and it had a lot of people on it from different circles. And of course it also had Robert Gates in the commission, who is now going to become the new foreign, the new defense secretary of the United States. Now, already as this report is out, the first thing that has happened is that the Bush administration has been saying, forget it. George Bush personally in Riga and later in his press conference after the meeting with Tony Blair said, forget it. We're not going to talk to Syria. We're not going to talk to Iran. They are our enemies, and that's it, basically. The Israeli foreign minister, who is right now, I think, in the United States, came out with a press conference saying, this Baker-Hamilton Commission, forget it, we're not going to... this is totally wrong. And Condoleezza Rice, after meeting with the German foreign minister, came out basically with the same thing, saying, forget about this with our... with meeting with Iran and Syria, we don't like this. Now, that does not mean that what is in the Baker-Hamilton Commission is dead. It means that the Bush White House is lobbying for their own impeachment. They're basically saying, impeach us. Please, get us out of this. We are not going to change policy. So, and the answer, in a certain sense, has to be from the institutions in the United States. If you're not capable of changing policy, we're capable of changing you. And that has to be on the agenda, and of course it's our job in the United States to really drive that point home. But it's not just us doing it now, in a certain sense. We still have to do our job. And if we don't keep pushing, nothing will happen. But if we keep pushing, what this Baker-Hamilton Commission is a reflection of is an institutional response. This is not one or two person finally seeing the light or seeing something is wrong. This is the institutional apparatus of the United States saying, now things has to change. At the same time, this is going to be a very dramatic ride, because also we spoke to military contacts after this, and after the report came out and what's going to come of it, and some military contacts said to us, yes, but the Cheney White House is still intent on having a war against Iran. And as it looks right now, that war will be with nuclear weapons. So it's going to be a very dramatic fight. It's with very high stakes. But it's a fight where we, each of us, has a very much power to actually intervene and shape things. I mean, we saw it with the election. I won't go through it. We have discussed it. But already, over the last 2 weeks, we saw it also very concretely with the effect it had when we revealed the Bush White or the Cheney White House plans for a war between the Sunni Muslims and the Shiite Muslims. How we could, in their fantasy world, you can say, they said, okay, we have to go to war against Iran. How do we do that? Well, we find all of the former enemies of Iran, the Sunni Muslims, and we mobilize them, and then they'll go with us. Together with us in a war against Iran. And not only that, of course, the Israelis are also against Iran, so then we just make an alliance between the United States, the Sunni Muslims, and the Israelis, and then we go to war against Iran, and isn't that great? And anybody that can think even a little bit knows that if you do that, if Israel attacks Iran, then you set off a war that will be there for a long time to come. I mean, basically, it's like setting off a 100 years war in the Middle East. And the Middle East being the center of all the, or being the, being having sacred places for all the main religions, so to speak, it automatically means that you launch, by having a 100 years war in the Middle East, you launch a 100 years religious war globally. And once it's set off, you don't know when you will ever be able to stop it. And we've tried this before. This is what happened in Europe between, basically between 1492 and onwards, but it ended up with the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, when all of Europe basically was just smashed by religious warfare and by armies. This one army, first the one army came and plundered everything, then the other army came and plundered everything, and population fell, and it was total misery. And it only ended then with the peace treaty of Westphalia in 1648. We went out on the orders of Lynn. Jeff Steinberg then made this memo, basically showing what was going on. That Dick Cheney went to Saudi Arabia with this idea of having this kind of Sunni-Shiite war. And then documented how the United States present government out of the White House right now is actively engaging in trying to create civil wars in Lebanon, that they are actually involved in arming the Sunnis to go against the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and actually using Al-Qaeda members to arm them. In Iraq, where you already have basically civil war ongoing. And the same thing in the Palestinian territories, where they were actively training and arming a Fatah army that is going to fight it out with the Hamas. So, in Jeff Steinberg's memo, this was all basically laid out. This is what is going on. This is the game that's being played. And it was put out, and within a couple of hours, this was becoming the leading news item. When you look up on Google News under Dick Cheney, then you got this report by Jeff Steinberg. And within 24 hours, it actually went around the world, and it was posted on websites, it got in newspapers, all over, especially, of course, in the Middle East, and all over the place. And we got it out in Arabic, of course, and so on and so forth. And this already showed this tremendous power we have in a certain sense. I mean, it's not a power. We don't run officially governments. We don't have lots of money. We don't have a big army. But what we do have is the power to understand what's going on, and at critical moments go in and expose, this is what is really going on. This is the setup. This is how you're going to be lured into destroying yourself. It already, to a certain extent, could say, worked. I mean, already now, all of these people that were supposed to be players in this game is beginning asking a lot of questions. They're not just marching along. I mean, and you see it. I mean, we just got a report that, for instance, one of our friends in France called into the office and says, you know what? At the Beirut Friday prayer, when they pray to, they have a prayer with 100,000 people, then they quoted Executive Intelligence Review. Then they went through that the American Journal, the Executive Intelligence Review is saying that the murder of Pierre Gamaliel is not what is being said to be, but this is actually the Americans and the Israelis that are behind. And all of these things are being used, and they actually have quite a profound impact.
Who's been murdered?
This, the minister that was murdered some, what is it?
A few weeks ago.
Yes.
Yes.
So there is...
She was the minister in this.
So,
yeah,
No, so things are in a certain sense heating up, but we are very much in this battle. I just want to take a reflection back, because now we had this, the theme of this cadre school was called the young man goes south.
Women.
Huh?
Women.
Young man slash women goes south. Yes. But this is actually a old slogan, so to speak. It's from 1982. It's actually from the time when I became active with the labor committees. This was, I had been over, I was studying, I went to with a friend to Sweden to see what is this all about, and began organizing, go out in the streets, and we went back home, and then in the fall there was going to be this conference, and Lynn issued this document, Young Man Goes Out. And this was in the midst of the international debt crisis. That back in 1971, the dollar was taking off the gold. And basically the Bretton Woods system was finished in a certain sense, but everything continued, and you had floating exchange rates. Then in the 70s, you had the big oil crisis, where suddenly the oil price went very high, and you had a lot of money suddenly moving from, you had the countries which had oil, and they got a lot of money, and you had the countries which imported oil, and they had to pay a lot of money extra. And all of the money that went from those that imported oil did not really go to the countries which produced the oil, it went to the international banks. So the international banks took money from one and put it out to the other and put a lot of interest rates on it, of course. And this was going on over the 70s into the 80s, and then in the beginning of the 80s, suddenly the rules of the system changed. I mean, a lot of third world countries had taken out also all over the place, South America especially, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and so on. They had big infrastructure projects. They were building dams, they were building all of this, and the banks were standing there saying, don't you want money? Here, take some money. Take a loan. Take two. Take three. And you can pay it back. Don't worry about it. So a lot of countries got heavily indebted, including Denmark also. But especially also in the third world. And then, in the beginning of the 80s, suddenly, the rules of the games were changed, and the interest rates were quadrupled. Four times over. It went like from 5% to over
20%. When did all the countries take all these debts?
In the 70s into the beginning of the 80s. At the time of the oil crisis. Because you had all of these money floating around. I mean, the banks were trying to get rid of it, get people to, or countries to lend it, or to borrow it. So this was in the 70s, and this was like, it was not a problem, everybody says it's a natural thing, you know, you borrow money, so what? And then it became a problem when suddenly the interest rates were quadrupled. And that created the debt crisis in 1982. And you had all of these countries suddenly sitting with a huge debt, and there were negotiations, what do we do? Because it was clear that with this game, they would never, ever be able to pay the debt. So what do you do? Now, at this time, LaRouche came in with a proposal and said very, it's very clearly, the world has to go on, countries have to develop, the general welfare of the world population has to be secured, therefore we have to make a reorganization of the world financial system. We have to take all of these debts and we have to transform them into long-term debts over 30 years, and we have to put it on an interest rate maybe of 1-2%. If we do that, the debt is out of the way, and we can have a massive economic development of all of the nations involved. And this became very concrete because LaRouche was very actively around me, we were having people going around meeting, talking to governments, trying to get them to move in South America. And in 1982, summer, fall 1982, the Mexican president López Portillo met with Lyndon LaRouche. They had a meeting, and López Portillo says, "This sounds great, make a program." And LaRouche wrote a report called Operation Juarez. How do we do this? The Mexican president began doing these things. And we then organized, and he then organized, for other countries in South America to join Mexico in basically saying, we don't pay any more debt until we have this new system. And Lynn at the same time was actively with our campaign organizing in the United States to get President Reagan to go along with this. To get the United States to join with South America in reorganizing the financial system. And it was a very big fight. What happened was that a lot of countries got threatened. Of course, Henry Kissinger personally went around threatening all these countries. And they got promises. If you do not go away with Mexico and all of these, if you go your own way, if you do as we say, we'll give you a specialty. And this they did to each country by itself. And what came out of it was basically that instead of reorganizing the financial system, it was decided that the way we're going to save the system is by looting the economies of the world massively, especially of the poor countries. Anyway, I just want to say as a comment, I mean, it's this young man goes out. I mean, Lynn basically said, what we now have an opportunity of changing the course of humanity in a certain sense by winning this fight in the South. That's our in a certain sense, also, our destiny here, for instance, in the United States and in Western Europe, is depending on making sure we win this fight. If we win this battle in the South, in South America especially, then that will change the world order, and it will improve situation for all of us. We then had a lot of funny things at the time, because when people heard that this was going to be the theme of the conference, Young Man Goes South, they all began, then people began, oh, gee, what? Argentina? I hear they have very good steaks. We have to move to Argentina? Now, if we have to move to Argentina, what would I need to have my CD collection with me. I need to... And they were beginning making all of these plans, you know, which wasn't really the point. But anyway, you had this fight. And what came out of it was because of lack of political leadership in a certain sense. I mean, the political leaders backed down in South America. They said, we'll rather go with getting a deal instead of taking a fight. What came out of it was that this did not happen. You did not reorganize the financial system. And instead it was decided to save the system by looting the economies. With the effect that in most countries in South America, the living standard were halved over the next 10 to 20 years. With the effect that in Africa, the African continent basically has gotten wiped out to a large extent. States disappear, AIDS takes over, no development. Up until 1982, there was a policy, you had development, you were building schools, you were building hospitals, you were building roads, you had an idea we're going to develop these nations. After 82, nothing. No money for the general welfare, only money for paying debt. Take all wealth in Africa, export it out of Africa. Take all wealth in South America, export it out of South America. So the fact that this was not done had a very concrete effect that hundreds of millions of people had died from disease, from hunger, from lack of development. Now we are, in a certain sense, come to a new intersection point, where after a lot of stuff has happened, we are back at a critical decision. The world financial system is again in a deep, deep, deep and profound crisis. What are we going to do about it? The debt is unpayable, this time for the United States. And the new thing is, in a certain sense, or what is going on right now is, if we do not solve it this time, it's not just South America and Africa that goes. It's the whole planet that goes. It's the dollar system. It's the world financial system. It's not that we can save the system by looting these countries. No, now it's the United States, Western Europe, the whole lot, basically, that's on the chopping block. So basically what we are in front of is the fight whether we reorganize things, we reorganize the system, or whether we simply let African conditions as we see them in Africa today becoming the standard for the whole planet. Disappearance of nation states, looting, all of this. Might not go in 1 year. It takes a little bit of time to do. But these things come on quite quickly. And of course, with the thing that if you do that, there will be nobody out there to come in and help out with a little bit of emergency aid and this and that. So, but this was the fight back then. And actually, I got it right at the time. I saw this opportunity. I says, because I was, at that time, I was 18 years old. And standing there and says, what do I want to do with my life? And I had a very clear idea that somehow I want to do good. But you can do that in a lot of different ways. You help a little bit here, you have a friend in trouble, you help him out, you help her out, you do this and that, you try to be nice. And when I then discussed with these organizers at the time, it got very clear to me that this organization they represented were something very unique. And that it's not only a question if I want to do good. Of course, it's a question and that should be settled very quickly. But the question really is, how do I do the most amount of good? I can go out and do a little bit here, a little bit there, try to be nice. Or I can be a catalyst. A catalyst. That is
initiator.
Not initiator, because there was a movement I could join. In a certain sense, right? But my effort put in the movement actually meant that instead of just doing a little bit of good, I would set off a lot of other processes. That I would catalyze other processes. That there was processes around latently there. Things that could happen, potentially. But would not happen unless they were set off. And I could actually develop the power to set off these other processes. So it would not only be me doing some good, but I would actually get a lot of people and a lot of processes to do good. Because it's always the case that most people cannot initiate the process. They cannot take the lead. They are hesitant, they are waiting, they're scared.
Too nice.
And they're too nice sometimes too. So there has to be somebody going forward and saying, follow me. And if you go forward, then even though they are scared, then it's easier for them to follow. Uh, Now, in the last, for my, since 1982, a lot of things has happened over the last, what is it now?
24 years.
So, yeah, 24 years. What we've done in that time, we've been fighting many battles, but we have also, by fighting all of these battles, and by LaRouche keeping making proportions, keep making initiatives, we have actually developed a fertile soil around the world, you could call it. We planted a lot of ideas, we've laid out a lot of things, which at the proper moment is actually ready to move on and do something more. And what it's all waiting for, in a certain sense, was a sign that a powerful force would in the world that could actually, and historically had proven that it could change the world, would be doing it. And this is the special role of the United States. But the United States has provenly again and again taking the leadership of changing the world for the good. Even when the whole rest of the world kind of were against it. So this is what we stand with now. We have a new American Revolution already ongoing. At the same time as we then have this Cheney attempt to set off a global 100 years war. So that's our job then. We can actually create that worldwide action that stopped this. I mean, it's, and then you have to look at history. I mean, in Germany you would say, think back at 1932. Think back at the time when it was not yet decided whether Hitler would take power or not. What would you have done? How would you have intervened to get other people to act? In Denmark we had it a little bit later. I mean, some people were worried about in the 30s and should have done more. You had it even with the resistance movement under World War II. What are you going to do? The Nazis are taking over. Are you going to just sit and watch? And like always, for instance, in Denmark at this time, it was like always the case, and like it was in the American Revolution, like it was at other time in the history, it was the youth that became the critical factor in a certain sense. But they, most people, I mean everybody of course had it upon them, what are you going to do about this? And most people says, well, I'm going to try somehow to survive. I'm trying to muddle through. I'm trying to make my way. And then hopefully, at some point, this evil nightmare will go away. This was what most people did under the Danish occupation. This is for sure what a lot of people did also in Germany under Nazism. You know, you try to survive. You try not to get in too much trouble. And then you hope someday it will all go away. Now, the reason we survived was it was not everybody thinking that way. That especially young people says that's not good enough. We are right now speaking about what's going to be the future of my country, what's going to be the future of the world. This is decisive historic questions. I cannot just be a passive observer and watch this. I cannot just go to school and learn about the big revolutions in history and this and that. I have to take part. I have to take a responsibility for this. Now, of course, when they did that, they got into a little bit of trouble. Not just from the system, but from their girlfriend, from the boyfriend, from the parents, from the grandparents. What? What are you going to do? You can't do that. You can't change the world. What do you think you are? You have to get your education. What if you get killed? Huh? What? Then we said we don't have our son anymore. And you even had, of course, you had young persons which had children. What if you get killed? Who's going to take care of your children? Huh? So you had all of this pressure that sure somebody should do something.
But
not you.
That's a classic.
And the point is that throughout history, not a lot of people, it was always very few people, decided to say, it is me. I am the historical person. I'm not just one of a mass of people that walks by and tries to, you know, to get through these, you know, 70, 80, 90 years, how many years you live. No, I'm the historical person. I will intervene. I don't know how it's going to turn out. But I know that if I do that, then first of all, my talents that I have will not go undeveloped. That the talent I have will actually be put to the service of mankind. And I also know that when I pass away, then I will actually be able to look back on my life and say, I lived and the world became a better place of my having lived. And that's what it's all about. Now we then have this special privilege that right now we're not just talking about a crisis or a problem. Right now we are at a point in history where the fight that was taken on by the founding fathers in the United States, by these young generals that Lynn is talking about, people like Lafayette and Hamilton and so on and so forth, this idea that there are certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness that all men should have. They were kind of secured for Americans, because if you look at the United States right now, it's not really like it's everywhere. It has to be re-won again. But now the world is a totally different place. Now the world is much more tied together. Now the world is much more integrated today. So this global crisis we have right now, sure, it may end up in being a terrible thing, and 100 years war, and all of these things are there, and they are possible. But at the same time, it's also the case, as we talked about yesterday, that right now, these principles from the American founding fathers and from the American constitutions, these can actually become global principles. That the general welfare will not only be secured for some privileged people that happens to be born in the right country, in the right place of the world, that they will have a chance to develop their talent, that they will have a chance to do something with their creative powers that might be of benefit to mankind, but that this can actually become something that extends to the whole planet. And this is very much possible to do, so to speak, not only in our lifetime, but actually to secure the basis of this in the coming very short time. So that's quite a privilege. You can imagine, what if you were born somewhere in China 3,000 years ago. And, you know, out in the middle of, out at some village, out in the countryside. And, you know, you were looking around and you say, hey, what's happening? I think we should do something. We should make history. And then somebody would you know, pat you on the shoulder and say, unfortunately, we right now have a regime in China that thinks that time is not right for change. But this regime has, and that the bad news is, this regime has only lasted 200 years. And normally they last 1,000. So maybe, you know, your grandchild will be able to change something. We're living at a time, at a place, where it's actually possible for us to directly intervene and be part of making these historic decisions. And that's a huge privilege. So, let's make the most of it. I think we take the rest and then we can take questions, we can discuss afterwards, because to make this more clear, what we're up against, Maya will present what it actually means to have a dark age, huh? And Stefan will present what it actually means to have a renaissance.
I don't know if that's what I will do, but I will. We will go back to because LaRouche always references to the Puritan body banks that collapsed in the 1345, and I wanted just to see what was the problem at that point, because what led up to that collapse? Like, why was that the greatest collapse ever in history? Because it's the same as today, what Tom went through. It's exactly the same patterns as LaRouche always references to. But I I never looked into why it was the same patterns. So I was looking at that, and it seems to be exactly the same problem, like Tom just referenced today with the IMF and all these several countries that are being killed by us. And we have to see, okay, what do we have to be able to think like if we want to recognize patterns that leads us into a collapse? Because that's what LaRouche's method is about, that you can recognize when you're leading into self-destruction. So what was it like again at that time that led into a destruction and collapse was, for example, I just want to show examples because I haven't gotten the time to put something big. But so there was like the monarchs was leading all over Europe, and they were just taken over more and more by the Venetian banks that were created around like 1250, and they were just given it, you know, conditions, because it was illegal according to the church to take interest rate. Therefore, you had to take conditions. You know, if I give you a loan, maybe you should trade in my currency, and then, you know, that's how like Venice infiltrated all the monarchs of Europe to trade in their currency, which was first silver, which was mined in Germany, and you know, Germany had to pay almost so that Venice could loot them. You know, it was like, and they also had to, like, the monarchs would have to give presents for the Venetians to be so nice, to sacrifice big paying to loan the money, which in the end, all the production and benefits, like grain and all that, would anyway be monopolized by the Venetians. So it would never come out to the population, it would finally be owned by private interests. So in that way, the Venetians had the opportunity to just speculate the prices up as high as they wanted to, without regulating. Because the biggest difference of today to now, or at that time to now, was that that time they didn't have nation states you could fall back to. You have that today, you can just fall back on nation states that could regulate the economy, like LaRouche is proposing with the US Constitution. You could just, you know, nationalize the banks. You didn't even have a nation state already there. So it was the banks, and that was monarchs. So it was bad condition, like condition for humanity. So anyway, in the same time, Venice had an alliance with the eastern countries, like in you know, the Genghis, no, what would they call the Khan, Mongols.
Genghis Khan.
No, I don't know if it's the same one. It's just called Khan, Mongols or something. Is it the Genghis? Okay.
I know that the Venetians used the Mongols, and especially these hordes of kind of army soldiers to deploy them into different areas.
Yeah, already before, like China had, in 200 years they had doubled their whole population, just before 1250 or something. So there was good production, there was good trade going on in the east, and then these Mongol people, they had, you know, killed all of them already. They destroyed the cities that were making good trade, because they worked with the Venetians, and if the good people of production were a threat to Venice, they would get killed by the Mongols. And the Mongols would loot China from gold, and export it to Europe through the Venetians, because it was a maritime culture. That's why they, you know, the Venetians, you know, shipped over to East and also to Africa, where they looted all the gold out. And they took all the looting they had of silver from Germany and you know, traded it for gold and slaves and cut back to Europe. And so in that way, actually, you know, the East used to have silver coins, no, gold coins, and Europe used to have silver coins for like many, many, many hundreds of years. But then Venice came in and they destroyed the Eastern gold coin and replaced it with silver, which had, you know, Venetian origin. That way Venice could control their currency too. And in Europe, they replaced the silver with gold. Like they would just, you know, and the people, because in Europe there was a lot of different currencies all over the place. So they had to exchange into Venetian money, because Venice was the big bank, you know. And if they wanted loans, they had to trade in Venetian money. So therefore they had to pay, fee for exchanging your money. No, because they couldn't take interest rate. But they had
commission.
To change, yeah, commission. And therefore, they had to pay that, and that got really, really high. So also, because they exported all the silver, they got 25% less of just circulation of money in Europe. Therefore, they couldn't. They just got a lack of money. They couldn't anymore have. The money circulation disappeared, so people would also get more, you know, poor. The production got destroyed from the monopolization of the kings, because actually, you know, they had like markets where they were selling all the raw materials, like gold and silver, but iron and clothes and all the like basic things. That was working fine, and they had to find, you know. Profit from it. Yeah, so anyway, then the Venetians, they got like, yeah, they said, yeah, that's a good market for me too. So they went in and they would just put luxury products there from the east and flood the market with their currency. And then they would kind of, you know, out-compete the normal small merchants through the currencies and through the speculation of the raw materials, because they sold so expensive. And then the normal merchants would disappear. That would mean also the production would disappear, and the whole, what it costed to produce really for the kings disappeared. So the kings couldn't produce, which was monopolized by Venice. So actually, the biggest way so that was when the collapse already started and already was happened. They were bankrupt. But that was like 100 years already before the real collapse came. But this is what LaRouche also talks about when he talks about the tsunami effect. When you have a whole, like, the tsunami starts on deep sea and the stream of water just gets very strong, and you don't see it on the surface really before it hits the coast, where the wave comes and hit over. But the tsunami started long before. And it was the head collapse. It already started long, long, long time before. And, yeah, there was no production, so the people would die already of epidemics. There was no sanitation. The people had to move to the cities. So there was no renewal of infrastructure. So it was all really just bankrupt. And then the domination of the whole market was actually the speculation of currency, from exchanging money into silver and gold and back again. And because every time
actually every time they would trade with Egypt or with, you know, the Mongols in silver and gold, every time the silver price had gotten up, which was the Venetian. So in that way, every time you made a new trade, it would be more, they would profit more. Actually, they expected 6,000 something percent of profit per year, which was quite much. Yeah, so that was like, yeah, that was like the, that was how they have, that was what the dominated the Venetian market was that speculation. It wasn't in raw materials or something. I don't know if I forgot something, but yeah, then the, you know, the plague came later because they shared diseases also, these Mongols and Venetians. So the, the plague came from China and was exported to the Black Sea, where it was, you know, shipped over to Sicily, and it spread over and killed all the people. Because already when it came to Europe, it had already killed, I think, 10 million people out of, no, I forgot, like, yeah, I think 10 million out of, no, 15%. Yeah, 15% of the world population was already killed in genocide in Asia. Mm-hmm. When it finally came over to Europe. And they worked really good together. The Khans would actually propose to Venice when they should go in crusades and which city they should occupy. And but then came the big speculators' own problem, which was that they shot themselves in the head, basically, because they, you know, finally, there was no more to loot, and there was no more, even if they also looted over in Asia, there was no more they could take. The body was dead. So they came up with the last trick, which just killed them, which was that they wanted to, then they started to bankrupt the gold price again. No, the they bankrupted, they let the silver price go up again. Which was a problem, because all the investments and all the infrastructure value stuff was invested in gold prices all over Europe. And so since it fell like more than 50%, the whole, you know, economy of Europe collapsed. And they bankrupted Florence. Venice bankrupted the own biggest banks. But so even though, you know, that happened, even though through the whole Black Death and all...
What time is it now?
This is 1320s. And the big banks didn't react before 14 or 15 years later. And then at that time, there was nothing that could reverse the crash and the Black Death and all that. And the real plague started. No, I mean, sorry, the big collapse happened around 1345 and a little later. So, and so then Malthus, you know, now he was like, he wasn't born yet, but he speaks theory and also on universities is that if you have just less people, you would have more for yourself. Therefore, it's good to kill people. And so he was, that kind of thinking was proved wrong, because after the Black Death, there was a lot less people, but there was not more for the survivors, because who should produce? You know, there was, why should the wages go up just because you're less people? You know, so it was, yeah. So that was just a disproval of that, and then actually that led into the Renaissance, because all these Venetian bankers were expelled from Spain and prohibited from England, and in Flanders they were imprisoned, and they were also expelled from Paris. So the whole world turned against Venice. And then that led into, you know, this organization of nation states by Louis the 11th of France, who was also a king, you know. Kings are maybe not all bad. And he created a nation state in 1461. And then, yeah, that was like the anti-Italian development of infrastructure. So, yeah, you want to...
So, I want to talk a little bit about the Renaissance and why we need, actually, a Renaissance in these days, again. So, if you are... Yeah, if you want to express Renaissance, what are you thinking? The first things I thought was just all these geniuses like Leonardo da Vinci or Brunelleschi, who constructed a couple of the Florence Dome. But I asked myself, that's not everything, because
we could, why we couldn't we have it this day, or why it wasn't all these geniuses a time before. So as because the main intention why there were so many geniuses or in this time was also connected to the intention of the human being. So, and in 1303, in Western Europe, there was the works of Plato and Aeschylus or Pythagoras was really vanished, and the ancient Greek language was forgotten. And also the leaders of the church couldn't speak Greek, couldn't read the original texts of the New Testament, and the only guy who really had survived from Greece was Aristotle. And he was totally evil. And so he, yeah, the academic life was in a miserable way, because there was just this Aristotelian view, which yeah created the view in the human being. And there was this guy William of Ockham. He was a teacher in Paris, and he was a very famous teacher of the school of nominalism. And he denied the capacity of the human mind to discover anything. And he said that the ideas are just an illusion and are abstract. So he defended the absolute predominance of the divine will, and he said that human beings are slaves who had no free will and were evil.
When is this? When?
This is in 1300 or something. And so, and he said, what? As long as God is a dictator whose words are law, so he could turn black into white and white into wrong. So that's the main idea of the human being before the Renaissance. And then you have to think about why is this view so evil? Because then you see the Rennie system use this kind of view to take humans as slaves. So then you had, because in this time, before the Renaissance, the churches, the Christian churches, were divided into Eastern and Western churches. And in the Eastern Orthodox Church, the situation was a little bit better with this. Because they had actually Greek as main language. And but also in 1300 there were forces which wanted to destroy or hide the Greek books, as especially the Orthodox fundamentalists. So, but there were some individuals who wanted to keep especially the ideas of Plato alive. These were in the Eastern Church a guy named Platon, and in the Western Church, Petrarch. So, Petrarch, he was born in 1305 and in Italy, and his family moved to Avignon. And Avignon in this time was the was the main city for the Western European Church, because one the Pope lived there. And he spent 25 years in this city, and he recognized there's something wrong between what is preaching by the popes, by the church, and the real life, the decadent life in the population. So, but he learned many scholars in this in Avignon, and then he decided to change something. Especially when he studied later Dante in Italy, and when he was back in Italy, and he was a great poem. He was he because you can say Dante was his
the
mind leader or something like this. And so in this way he found it out that the only way to salvation for the population would be by overturning the social axioms. And in this way he created a youth movement for part was to rediscover the Plato, the ideas of Plato, and who should play a key role to figure out the capacity of the individual mind. So in the Western Europe you had great problems to find some books of Plato, and so Petrarch and all these guys used much time just to find some, and then to find some guys who would translate it. So, but in the Eastern Church there was this guy Platon, and he was born in 1316, and he was educated by Jewish and Muslim scholars. He also led a group of scholars who were looking into Platonism as a way of reforming the Orthodox Church. And Platon saw the only way to really get out of this social process which were acting in this time by he thought that this is connected with the dialogue between the religious with the churches, and he fought against the Aristotelian view, and he wanted to create a reunification between these churches. So there was this main problem, because the Orthodoxian view was that God's nature is infinitely different from man's, and therefore it's incommunicable. But Platon said we have to introduce the Platonic ideas defines that the Platonic ideas are a part of the energy of God, and human beings can comprehend him. So, that's led us to the main question. So, what's the difference between the Renaissance and the time before? So, it is also connected to the question of the view of defining of human being. And you have to see the relationship between God and man. And you have to think of it, is the human mind just controlled by the creator? Or is the human mind, can the human mind get out of the sense perception way and look behind? So I have a quote from Petrarch. And he said that sense perception and mere learning by memorizing facts has nothing to do with true knowledge. So, and Petrarch and Platon, they were such great fighters for the ideas of Platon. And so you have to know why is this view of Plato so necessary to for the human development. And so one guy of the youth movement of Plato, he is Niccolò Niccoli, and he has a quote to a sophist in this time, because Sophism was also great invented like in ancient Greeks. And he spoke to one guy quote. What's the meaning of life? If it's just pleasure, you don't know anything about history. If you don't learn that you are good for nothing, as soon as the flower of your youth is gone, you'll be a miserable man without virtue. And all these guys, Platon and Petrarch, they just made it a landslide for Nicolaus of Cusa, and he was the main key figure to create a Renaissance, because he followed the way and wanted to reunificate the churches, and he led to the question of filioque, and this was discussed later in the Council of Florence. Because you had the main difference views about in these divided churches. The Roman Church was thinking that the Holy Spirit just proceeds from both. The Holy Spirit proceeds from both the Father and the Son as one principle, and the Orthodoxian view was that the whole Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. And if you have looked, if you want to look in this, then you see that this is more than a fundamental debate, because it's all you. It's also a debate on the method and the value of man. So Nicolaus of Cusa has. I want to give a quote from him, and he said, "The finite being is evil to the degree that he forgets that he is finite, believes with satanic pride that he is sufficient unto himself, and lapses into a lethargy which prevents him from developing all his powers, hence preventing him from discovering with himself the promise of his actual divine origin." So the question of filioque is so special, because it's also the question of what's the difference between man, human being, and God. And Nicolaus of Cusa, he had this idea, or just followed the idea, that when with Christ, who was at the same time man and God, he made in the image and likeness of God, and in this way with the passion and the resurrection was man's redemption made possible. So, and Nicolaus von Cusa, he wrote many books, which were important for especially our life too, because he was the creator of the modern scientific world, and his one book, was preparing the creation of the founding of a nation state, which later was Louis the 11th. And Nicolaus of Cusa also prepared the ecumenical peace. And what made him so special is that he used the method of Plato. So now I want to come to the question why we need a Renaissance today, why it is so important. Because actually we have the same problems like in those times before. We have also a view of human being that they are evil, and so in this way we can't develop ourselves out of this crisis. And it seems like in our culture that is just yeah, based on sense perception, and we all say, okay, it's just my life, and I want to get as much pleasure as I can. And yeah, with this thinking, with this baby boomer thinking, you can't create anything, and you can't make a real development. And we also have a big mysticism, so we have lost our ideas, the connection between God and human being. So. No, they didn't work together because Platon was in the Eastern Church, but they had the same ideas to keep the ideas of Plato alive.
Platon.
It's the follower of Platon, the translation. He gave his insight to me.
I thought it was interesting, the quote you had there. When he said, was it Kusa who said that it was something that people, they don't know that they are finite.
Man is the ultimate
that
awesome.
You know, when Lynn said the
yeah.
first thing human beings need to discover is that they're going to die someday.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can go from there.
You stay up here.
Hmm?
You have to stay up here.
Yeah. Yeah. Any questions?
Yeah.
I find this what you said about this with you, because you know, big boomer culture, right?
Hmm.
It's the parents of my generation and of your generation.
Hmm.
And this that we our my generation and your generation is actually has gotten it with the mother milk to actually base the whole way of thinking on sense perception. So this is very interesting that you say this about it. We see normal people evil. Would you like to say something more about that? Like, you know, what is the view of the younger generation on human beings, since the human beings are just objects for
okay.
them?
I just remember one discussion with a friend of mine. I think it was 1 year ago, and she want to have animals, and I think that's the main question, because we have a generation who is not thinking that human beings are have a value. And she even said, yeah, I just love more to help animals than human beings, because the human beings are, they have, it's their own mistake, that they are vanishing themselves. And I think that's a good intention to see how our population or our viewing of the human mind of ourselves so is so totally collapsed.
Yeah, it's a very anti-human culture, really. And also this connection of or more disconnection in a sense, human beings in this society, or human beings is part of creating our societies, creating our cities. Because I know in Germany we have had a lot of discussions with Helga back and forth about, you know, during the 60s and 70s, anti-technology, anti-people, actually. Yeah. No, do please continue.
But, you know, like, how do we train people then to start, because to start believing in the goodness and beauty of people, because it's not necessarily something, with most people, what I see is it's not necessarily an idea that they have, it's something that's so ingrained in them, that it's not only something that they consciously believe, that they always say, when they meet someone they think, oh, this person is evil, but something that they act upon, something in them, so ingrained in them that you can't really say you think someone is evil, because you'll be like, no, I don't think people are evil, it's just that I think people are bad and they do bad things
mm-hmm.
and all of that. But, you know, how do we make people change that mindset? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
it's
so ingrained in people so much. You know?
Right. People are not conscious of it, that it's very much there. I mean, you can have discussions with people on the streets, and of course they wouldn't say, I hate people, I think people are bad, I think we should just kill them.
Mm.
But if you have a discussion, a longer discussion, you sooner or later get to the point where, you know, these things actually pop up, and that's more or less what they're saying. Without being conscious about it, without really knowing actually where it's coming from, or how are these ideas, like you say, imposed on people in the society.
That is also because I think about the social thing, because how we have a generation, especially in the Western countries, where they have the freedom actually to do something big, because they don't have to suffer of starvation, they actually can use their mind, but they are internally so destroyed emotionally that they cannot socially interact with others. So it's like, it's a big burden. I see this also, like, you know, we're building a youth movement, but what is keeping people away is that they cannot socially interact with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a real problem, because how do we get the dynamic that actually the basis of a renaissance is love to your fellow human being? And since we even that, you know, we are in the beginning of a youth movement, and that is still like the missing link, you know. And I just thought it was very good that it comes from you. That's because I thought, you know, oh, maybe it's just me, you know, thinking, oh, yeah, but it's really, I don't know. But
I think, back to your question, I mean, the music has just proven itself over and over and over and over. And I remember myself when I went to United States a couple of years ago. I just been a member in Sweden for a few months, basically. And I never been singing before. And then we were singing in Philadelphia office. And after a couple of days, I just started crying all the time. We started singing, and I just started crying. And I'm like, this is so embarrassing. You know, here we are in the United States, and they must think I'm a total wimp. And, you know, I'm just crying all the time. And it was just so emotionally all the time, and I just couldn't figure out what the hell is going on. So I spoke to a couple of people in the office, older members, and they said, well, that was one of the greatest discoveries of my life, because he said something that I realized was just really, really true. He said, you have been trained to do things that is very much against your nature. You have been trained to do things you never really wanted, things that never made you happy. You have been, you know, more or less just suppressed in a society where you have all these from parents, from teachers, from neighbors, from relatives, that you just trained to be a nice little good Swedish girl, and you know, it's not really you, it's just a crazy society. So the singing just, you know, kind of brought up so much kind of emotions and thoughts and things. So it took a couple of weeks, and then it was fine, but it was just that thing. So the music is something that kind of grips people, but you can't really say what it is in a sense. But it's something just very emotional, very fundamental, that brings out a sense of beauty that actually give people an idea that people can create beautiful things. People are actually good. Human beings are something very special with a very, you know, special gift, which comes out in terms of creativity.
So basically, you need to educate people a different way, like educate people to
to see the beauty in people, through singing, through other means.
Yeah, somehow, I mean, just directly on the streets, you can have people passing by the book table, and they might not think it's a big deal. But as soon as we have the chorus out there, you see people, they're coming, they're so busy, they have to go now, it's Christmas, everybody has to run around in Christmas shopping and this and that, and picking up the children, and they have tons of stuff to do when they don't have time. But then when they hear the chorus, they kind of slow down, and they start to turn around, and then they stop, and then they can stand there for 10, 15 minutes and actually listen. But if it wasn't because of the music, they were just like, oh, can't type, no time, you know. But also give people opportunity themselves to discover that within themselves.
Yeah, because you cannot train people. This is actually what is the difference between human beings and animals. Because you have to get them to rediscover that they're human beings.
That's also then for the youth movement, because one thing is to tell somebody, this is how it is. Hey, that's how it is. But the biggest gift you can give to somebody is to let them discover what it means to be a human being. Which means you cannot just have somebody tell you this is how it is. Then you've learned basically nothing. It could be just as well as being in school. You know, like, oh, in school they say people are evil, you say they're good, okay. And then you have the new answer, right? But you have to discover it, so therefore you have to be engaged in activity where you yourself discover, even if it's just doubling a square. Doubling a square is a proof to yourself that you can, that you are actually creative. You can solve problems, you can do things. And therefore singing, of course, watching singing is good. If you can get people to engage in singing, it's even better. Because then you develop yourself as a human being, emotionally and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they're taking away from people. I mean, people are being totally pacified. They are being entertained. You know? You're supposed to either do what you're told or do nothing and be entertained. Never do something, you know, discovery just to discover something and be happy. No, we don't do that here. Then the problem is, when you live in a sewer, you tend to get dirty. We go out on the streets and organize. And we go into a climate that is very pessimistic, degenerate, you know, and if you're even together with young people, you know, they should be happy, they should be positive, enthusiastic, but they're not always like that. So, therefore, you need to worry a little bit about your soul, because you go out on the street and you organize. It's like going into the gut, going into the soul. And you feel pulled down after being there sometimes. I mean, you feel, oh. And you come back and you feel totally exhausted, oh. And you feel like you don't want to speak to anybody ever again. So then you have to think, how do I clean my soul in a certain sense? How do I give that nourishment? So you need beauty, you need beautiful music, you need to sing, you need music, you need to discover new ideas. And then as you do that, you get to be your own self again, the real self. Not this, but, you know, a human being that discovers new idea. And then when you made a new discovery, you can go back into to this, you know, pessimistic climate and do something. And that's why Lynn also says, we have to sing. You can't just say we don't have time for singing, sorry. Because if you don't keep keeping your spirit, if you're not in your right mind, you cannot either help other people get in that way. And that's why it's very difficult, you know, even, I mean, you go into some other circumstances, you're all by yourself, you know, you visit old friends, you go to family, you know, and very quickly you fall into this trap of a world where these things don't exist, and you feel, you know, sometimes you can't fight it, and then you're just trapped there. And if nothing happens, you might sit there still 10 years later. Didn't leave the chair. You fell into a hole and you can't get out again. So therefore, we also have to help each other. Being in, keep developing, keep our mental powers. And
because it has very much also to do with the idea of change that Peter was talking about a little bit yesterday, that, you know, the human mind is a very kind of, how do you say, it's like one big growing, not muscle in a sense, but it's something that needs training, needs activity, needs challenges. And if that doesn't happen, your physically, your brain activity actually shuts down. That is something that is very dynamic and it's created in a way so it's supposed to develop, supposed to grow. And I think the thing with, you know, the boomer and tweener and stuff like that we discuss sometimes, that all the boomers are like this and so on, that's nothing inevitable. In a healthy culture, you create people like Linda LaRouche or Helga or Amelia Bonte-Robinson, where people grow and develop from the day they're born to the day they die, basically. I mean, it's not just now we live in a period of history where you have these crazy operations, interventions into the society where that whole generation just shut down their brain, basically. But if people do not kind of challenge themselves and each other to actually move forward and develop and grow and discover new things, it's a lawful process that people get unhappy. You get frustrated. It's stagnation. And the human mind is not created in that way. So if we, because I had a discussion with my mother a while ago, and I tried to tell her why we do the science work and the music work and the Kepler. Why do we look into all these things? Why do we work on all these things? And after a while she said, I'm sorry, but I just don't understand what you're talking about. It's not that I don't want to, but she just couldn't actually intellectually grip what it was that we were talking about. And it's, you know, when people get demoralized, it's usually just a sign of, yeah, you kind of reach to a level where you get a little bit stuck, and that's like the critical moments, and these comes all the time. But then, you know, you have to fight that through and take a step forward, and then you become even stronger and probably a better human being in a sense. And then, I mean, everybody here knows about that you have, yeah, it's healthy. It's like not the linear process. You decide to join, you become one of the good ones, and then it's just, you know, the highway to heaven or whatever. It requires a little bit of work. And again, it's this, I mean, it's a fight. It's a personal fight that you have to do with yourself, and also try to help others and find, so it says, find ways of make sure that you move forward as a person.
The funny thing is, the biggest breakthroughs you normally make when you are, to begin with, in a totally, you don't want to, you're totally blocked. And then you don't want to do anything, and you want to run away from the whole thing. But then you decide not to do it anyway. It's a little bit like you let your free will takes charge and says, no, I'll do something with this. So it's not like you, because somebody told you that you had, it's not somebody that ordered you. No, it was you yourself ordering yourself to do what you really want to do. And when you do that, and then you work on something, often out of what was seemingly a big crisis, you get some big breakthrough. And Lynn does this a lot. A lot of the biggest breakthroughs Lynn makes, he makes in the most terrible and difficult times he has. The whole thing is going, everything is going to hell. He's in, you know, being put in jail, this and that. And he could, you know, and some would people say, should be sitting, being worried about myself. Oh, poor me. I have all these problems and so on and so forth. I have earned the right to be miserable. And instead what he does is he says, no. And then he sits down and really focus on important issues, and he makes a breakthrough. And this is totally unexplainable in one sense, because this defies all logic. Because according to all logic, the circumstances decides what comes. And if you have miserable circumstances, and you are there, you will become miserable, and that's the end of the story. But we have such a thing which defies logic, which is human creative reason, and which is human will, which is human passion. And that means that even though you're in the most terrible circumstances, and usually you should be miserable, you make a scientific breakthrough, you make a breakthrough in the way you understand things, and when you should be miserable, you're happy. And it defies all logic, because we human beings are more powerful than logic.
That's why people also stuck with the chorus, because I was just thinking, when you asked the question, you said the problem is sense perception, because people all around them see people being miserable or doing bad things or just going along. And so logical conclusion is, well, man must be bad. And look at the history a little bit, what you get taught in school, empires, slavery, wars, you know, it's all terrible. So but the funny thing is you're against it, right? You have this sort of natural impulse, you don't like that, right? But you at a certain point, if you don't discover something else, you think that's normal and you go along with it, or you get crazy because you think I must be crazy because everybody else does this crazy thing. That I had that idea for a while. Am I crazy?
Yeah.
Because everything around you seems to be so homogeneously crazy. So when people see the course, I think about this a lot. Like, it's like they're stepping into a different universe. People look like this, right? And the younger they are, the more honest they are. Like, these kids must be born in a different universe. And they're right. Because, in a sense, because, I mean, you don't see that usually. Young people from all ages, from all genders, all colors, whatever, you know, and they're singing. And what people see is a picture of what humanity ought to be and what humanity can be. That humanity can actually function on the basis where you communicate, as Petra said, beautiful ideas. And this goes, and if you look at Lynn's latest paper, The New Politics, and all the other papers, what he comes back to and back to and back to all the time is, what is creativity? Right? Because that's what I mean when people say they're against it, but they don't know what they are, why they are against it, what it is, why they don't like it, and what they should be. If they don't have this idea, well, why do we have this moral impulse, or whatever you want to call it? Now, what is it to be human? And Lynn is, I think, the best person ever lived in history who has really demystified this idea of creativity. It really made it accessible to people what it means to be creative, what it means to be human, why this is actually something normal. And then it's not anymore abstract, or you get an access through our movement, what we're doing here, also right here today, with this idea with the catenary, and then it becomes more clear what Stefan talks about in the Renaissance, what actually means to be human, and how to give other people an access to. And when you ask, well, how do we do it? Then it's lead by example, right? But it means you have to develop your own mind with these great ideas. Because then, with the music, it works because it's something more visual than with just five people at the book table standing there with maybe some funny signs. But if you have a chorus, it's obviously a completely different culture you're seeing. You're seeing something that doesn't fit, not normal. Should be.
You know, Lynn has this great paper, what's it called again? Something with morality.
Morality?
Yeah, exactly. Where he is saying that the greatest crime done to people in humanity is taking away
opportunity to develop the potential they have. Because there's one thing to point out what's bad, but the question then is, again, the question of culture, of the music, of science, creativity, what do we want instead? What is it that is lacking today that we have to bring back? What is it that the society is about to lose that we have to recreate in a sense? And that's very tricky because, you know, discuss something like beauty, for example, is not that easy because it's something that most of us have not really had any sense of actually, because it's not Britney Spears, it's not, you know, MTV Hollywood or this modern art where you just have a bunch of colors thrown on a wall or whatever. So that, I find it very difficult sometimes to actually somehow grasp these ideas because it's something that it just really doesn't exist anymore in the society. So it's something we have to bring back and build up and also build up within ourselves to be able to bring that out to other people. But when you reach that point where you start to discover things and you give that to people, then you see really, you know, what is actually happiness? Because we work on these stuff, like Portia said yesterday, not because we want to become some kind of clever elite that is walking around and showing how much we know about certain stuff, but it's, you know, in order to bring that out, to be able to give that to other people. Because most people today, they just have no idea who they are. You know, we never really got the opportunity to figure out who, you know, every single unique individual, you know, we have one life. There's no one as you on the planet ever in history. So, you know, what's your character? What's your personality? How do you develop that? How do you let that come out and go? And that's when, you know, you just enter, yeah, something much more exciting.
Where self?
Hmm? What?
Where self?
Where self, yeah.
You mean relative to Scandinavia?
Yep.
That's why the idea came out. Yeah, I wanted something with him. No, because here we are in Scandinavia, you have a nation of 8 million and a nation of 5.5 million, or 8.3 million. It's like, you know, in the center of the universe, even though the Danes speak something, and sometimes think that. But it's like, if you really want to move something, what we do in Berlin, what we do in Paris, it's like the center of it. It is, you know, all ego about, you know, all nations in the best system. Put aside one has to grow to be a world citizen in times like this, because we share the destiny of mankind. And I think nobody, I mean, if there's any open questions, especially for the ones who are new and also who are, you know, not fully 100% yet, also maybe if they are part of the movement, they should really take it up, because there's no time to waste. We are going to win a big a political fight, and we have to win it now. The new Congress is coming in here in the beginning of January. Up until then, every minute is like eternity. Really, everything we do in terms of one political force is going to decide what comes out of when the new Congress comes in. Following what we do in the US, following what Lim's doing, is like a part of conceptualizing what we can do here. And the best thing is what we do in Berlin, because it's there that makes really sense. So the next, I don't know, holidays, or I know, you know, this is now Christmas and New Year and all of this stuff comes together. they all the Scandinavians turned to the ex-Christians, they think.
Sorry,
for yeah, at
least for 2 days. To get the guests.
Yeah, yeah. They forget that they're
I can be a Christian if there's a big enough gift for me.
If they forget the essence of the actually the love for mankind is why we're Christian. But so there's going to be a period now coming up where there's going to be a lot of 3 days especially, and don't plan them out. Come to Berlin, come there and work with us in the Kepler and mobilize. Actually, this is the thing what Carsten is talking about. They're going to do a lot of that. They're going to have big fires, I guess so.
Carols.
Yeah. So it's going to be a very active full, actually, December in Berlin. So don't waste your time up in Scandinavia.
Unfortunately, it's true.
I give people some pamphlets as a Christmas gift.
Yeah. It's soon time to mobilize for the next webcast, too.
When's
11th of January.
Yeah. In Berlin?
I don't
no.
think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I want to ask a question. Is it now because. The Senate and also the Congress, the two Congress, they will not start the new one, they will not start maybe after 1 month, I mean after the Christmas. But now Bush and Cheney, they have all the power, I mean Bush, ultimate power to have decisions like declare war or these things. I mean during this time without, because there's no Congress actually now.
It's a little, it's could be, there was actually a question when this Baker Hamilton from study group were making their report to the Senate. Senator Burr actually came up with a question and says, do you think it would be time to do away with this War Powers Act that the Congress had made, which gave Bush the power to make war? And first the question was ignored, he asked it again, and Hamilton, he said, yes, you're probably right, that would be a good idea. And then Baker, who's a Republican, said, well, if Hamilton, who's the juridical expert, thinks so, I think it would be a good idea too. Which is that there is this danger that you have to really be conscious of reining in and controlling the White House, that they don't do crazy things, because I think they are in the process of basically, they made some continuing resolutions right now, saying that the, up until the 15th of January, the budget will just keep rolling. So basically, the Congress don't have to meet up until February.
Yeah.
So it is dangerous.
Yeah.
But it will. But I'm sure. I mean, we work on that, make sure people do not know it, and the Democrats will not go home. They will stay in Washington, a lot of them. They will be working on doing all of these things, but it's dangerous time. But it's a lot more difficult now. First you had the election, then you had this Baker-Hamilton report, and basically what it means is that what the election proved is that if you do something like go against Iran, you will not have the backing of the population. Baker-Hamilton Commission proves you will not have the backing of the institutions. So this is powerful means to try to prevent it. So so if the White House says we just do it, you will have a lot of military officers, you will have a lot of intelligence officers that says that immediately when they say it, begin to run out the room, make phone calls.
And then now they depend on this this kind of religious war. They want to do it, mobilizing the Sunni against the Shia and against Iran, and also maybe they depend on Israel.
Israel to start something, so they have an excuse.
Yeah.
Yes.
On what basis would the impeachment be on Bush and Cheney? What would be the thing that they impeach Bush and Cheney on specifically?
Specifically, you would, in over the next weeks and months, you begin to investigate many different things. You have a long list of things that's been done illegally. And then you choose the most gained some of them, and then you begin to investigate. And then you get people to come in under sworn affidavits, give testimony, and then you get crimes. Then you get things that specifically is against the Constitution. So you simply do this, and then you get the stuff, and then it's a question, is there a certain kind of political decision that you go for?
So is the Congress who's going to initiate this process?
Yes. So Congress initiates it, it's the Congress that basically decides.
What are you going to do?
So I think it might be the Senate that it initiates it, the Congress that has...
That's the
representative that's initiating. But so you have this, but it's...
It has to be voted for the Senate.
Yeah.
It's not related to the Supreme Court.
Well, the Supreme a judge from the Supreme Court, I think, is presiding over the proceedings. But he's not the judge.
But there's these four major issues, huh?
Crimes and misdemeanors. They've done so many legal things. Just the things like spying on the Americans,
yeah,
without this and that. This whole torturing thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can pick it. I mean, it's like, you know, take your pick. What do you like?
Yeah.
So much.
Also, the Iraqian war and all these things.
The big thing is, you don't want to do it, though. See, this is the thing. You don't want to impeach a president, because you don't want to set the precedence that a president is being impeached, because that might weaken the presidency and you don't like that. So you try not to do it. But the problem is that right now the White House is having such a big campaign for impeachment that you might have to do it. But what you want to do is what you did with Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with Nixon, the case was, it was being decided, Nixon has to go. This guy is crazy. Now, then you had the process. He had a crazy vice president too, Spiro Agnew. So what you did was, first, you had a case against Spiro Agnew. When he was a governor, before he became a vice president, years ago, there was some bribery thing. So they picked that up, and they made a case of it, and Spiro Agnew made a plea agreement and agreed to withdraw as vice president and pay a fine, and then you put in a new vice president, Gerald Ford. And then once you had Gerald Ford as a new vice president, who was not Nixon's real choice, he had a lot of other candidates he would have had, but he could not get them approved in the Democratic Congress. Then when Gerald Ford was the vice president, then you went to Nixon and say, you have a choice. You want an embarrassing impeachment trial, or you go quietly. And if you go quietly, you'll still be called Mr. President. You'll still have all of these. They do that in the United States. But once you're president, you're president. You're the title you keep for life. We'll honor you, we'll respect you, we'll do a lot of different things. If you do not go, then you'll get impeached, and you'll be the first American president ever to get impeached. It's your choice. And that you have to do, this was done. So you try to do it that way.
First Cheney,
then Bush, and this double thing, yeah.
That will be a horrible problem. If Cheney would be the president, so...
The big difference is, we have talked about this, but now you suddenly have people like, I mean, and up until now, the old Bush Senior and his people have not been willing to accept that you had to impeach Cheney. They have said, no, we don't want to go there. Now there might be a change, because it's so dramatic. That there's no other way. Sure, we would like another way, but if there's no other way, impeach Cheney, impeach Bush. Impeach Cheney, maybe Bush then will stay in and you get a new vice president that takes over. Kind of.
Yeah.
A new puppet master. Somebody to give him his pills.
Yeah.
Now the other big thing was, you had with this present, when they made this presentation of the make a Hamilton report.
Mm-hmm.
What is his name? This new guy that came in. One of the new guys, the Democrat, Lawrence Eagleburger, I think it was, that got in, was then asked, well, when they presented the report, well, how did Bush take it? Because they had an early morning meeting at 7 o'clock with Bush, telling him what's in the report. And he says, oh, Bush, I don't think he understood much of it. He was loaded already. Drunk, that's what he said.
Yeah.
Nobody knows if he means he really was drunk, or because he's an old alcoholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was just metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
Wow.
Either way, it showed this totally disrespect. It's something you cannot say about your president. You cannot do this. Unless he's not the president really anymore. So I think it was Eagleburger.
So, what is the movement doing in America then to get this impeachment going? Are they going to be speaking to the Congress? Or?
Yes. We have our youth movement is knocking doors, banging on the door, says you have to go for impeachment, you have to go for impeachment. There's mobilization on the street for this.
Senator John Conyers from Michigan is someone that we have been working with, that people in the youth movement have actually been coming out for discussing with him, and he has invited a couple of people to different meetings, they have given speeches there and so on. And he is now going to be head of the Judiciary Committee, which is a pretty good situation.
It's the committee that's going to start the impeachment process.
Okay. I mean, Lynn expressed it, he says, we push their process. The Congress will not go out and speak about it because they have to be the judge of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have to speak about it. We have to push. We create the pressure.
Okay.
And then, as the crimes come up, then you do it. So you should not be, because you don't see on the front page of the papers every day saying impeachment process begun. That's not how it works. It's like you create the climate where it's necessary, where it's possible,
mm-hmm.
and then it's being done, but maybe it's not being done because you then convince people to step down. I mean, Cheney, the deal with Cheney is, you know, he has heart problems, all of this, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I have to resign. My wife says she wants to see more of me, which of course is a lie. She misses her dick, which is a lie. But anyway. anyway, whatever. But we have to create the pressure. We cannot give in. We cannot give the leading. We have the momentum, so we have to move forward. It's a little bit like in war. General Patton has this book where he writes about this. You know, you come to a war, you win the battlefield, and you're very tired, and you want to lay down and rest for a little bit. But what you do is you always go to the other side of the river. Don't stay on this side of the river and say, I can cross the river tomorrow. Because tomorrow when we want to cross the river, the foreign troops have regrouped and taken it back. And then you might be standing for a week fighting to get to across the river. So when you have the momentum, move forward. Even if you're tired, even if you think maybe we should rest for a little bit.
Let's take it easy for a while. It's also very much that, you know, people have difficulties grasping how these processes is ongoing. Unless they really see it, so to speak. A little bit was Michael Kirsch was talking about yesterday on the phone, that, you know, how can we figure out a way of doing certain things that we know it will generate an effect, and then exactly maybe how large or when or how and so on, but that you have a direction of your action so you know it's going to have an effect, which is a, you know, we have done a lot of work in Washington D.C. in the last 3 years, the youth movement, which has been, it was a process in the beginning where every Wednesday they have action weeks, and then they go lobbying with
in the beginning, you know, they were just kicked out or called the police, and it was quite tumultuous. Then a couple of people kind of picked up some material and read a little bit, but they would never, ever, ever, ever say they have read it. And then 1 year later, you had actually some people started calling into the office, asking them to come. So it's a, you know, there's a lot of work behind it that I think a lot of people, they don't know what they haven't heard about it, so they don't really see it. But all this has created, what Tom was saying, the dynamic and the climate really for potential of big changes, like the election that the Democrats won. And I guess keep at them during the Christmas.
We don't let them, don't let them go. This is what happened last year. We had the Congress going. I mean, throughout 2005, we got them mobilized to stop the privatization of Social Security. They were in good shape. They went home for Christmas vacation and they never came back. That's the problem. When we got the election, now we are back, so we should not, you have to keep at it. And then what the other thing again, like we talked yesterday, we have to take this victory from the United States to people here in Europe. They don't get it. They don't get it from the media. Yes, they hear it was a victory, but not what it actually means. We have to explain that to them so they can be remoralized, so they can have hope that they can actually be changed. If you sit down in Africa or in Asia or in Europe, you say, oh, we can't change anything. Yes, we can. No. So let's do it. And that's our job.
Yeah. Yeah, continue kicking at us.
Yes. So? Huh?
Yeah.
I think I think it's time to have lunch and
yeah.
We can be.
And then go south.
And then go south.
Yeah, but just say thanks for everybody participating, and I hope everybody is going to take themselves seriously.
Thank you, Fina, and thank you very
much. You're welcome.